I'm Anna Garcia with True Crime News, the podcast. Every crime tells a story. Every story demands justice. True Crime News, the podcast, covers breaking crimes, investigating high-profile and under-the-radar cases. Every week, we dive beyond the headlines, exploring the effects of violent crimes on victims and search for justice. We hope you join us as your weekly source for True Crime News. Listen to and follow True Crime News, the podcast, on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From KNX News 71 FM,
this is Countdown 2024.
Here are Charles Feldman and Margaret Carrero.
Well, 38 days to go until the Trump transition. Welcome again to Countdown 2024. Last week, we did a show on the very passionate debate over gender-affirming care for transgender youth. We had somebody on who was very pro. Today, we will have the other side of that debate. Also on today's show, why is the Trump administration considering axing several of the nation's banking regulatory agencies? We'll try to answer that. But first this.
Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi nursing a fractured hip after she took a hard fall down some marble steps while she was on a trip to Luxembourg. The 84-year-old San Francisco representative is in the hospital after the fall. She was traveling through Luxembourg as part of a bipartisan congressional delegation. Pelosi's injury comes amid reports that she was lobbying opposition against Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in her younger colleague's bid to become the ranking Democrat on the House Oversight Committee.
The New York Times is reporting that Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s lawyer, who's helping the Health and Human Services nominee select potential federal health officials to serve in the incoming Trump administration, has petitioned the government to revoke its approval of the polio vaccine, which for decades has protected millions of people from a virus that can cause paralysis or death. While RFK Jr. has said that he is not interested in using his possible HHS post to deny access to vaccines, his lawyer has taken repeated legal action over the years to get various childhood vaccines pulled from the market.
President-elect Donald Trump will be in attendance and likely play a starring role at the annual Army versus Navy college football game on Saturday. It will be Trump's fifth time seeing the storied military matchup. His pick to lead the Defense Department, Pete Hegseth, will also be there alongside him. Trump has had a history of making news at previous Army-Navy football games. Back in 2018, he tweeted out in the middle of the match that he was firing Joint Chiefs Chairman General Joseph Dunford.
As I said last week on this show, in the wake of the U.S. Supreme Court hearing arguments about restricting gender-affirming care for minors in the state of Tennessee, we talked with transgender activist Charlotte Clymer, who argued that these treatments can be life-saving.
When a child comes out as transgender, there is a rigorous process for that child to, or that youth, to access gender-affirming care. One of the many points of disinformation is that trans youth are getting surgeries, which is just not true. These are life-saving medical interventions. Every study that's been put out by this has shown that the rates of suicide, the rates of depression, decline dramatically for trans youth who do have access to gender-affirming care. So, I mean, this really is about life-saving health care for trans youth.
Our guest today takes a very different approach to transgender medical care. Dr. Julia Mason is a pediatrician and board member of the group Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine. Dr. Mason, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So as succinctly as you can, can you explain why you clearly have a very different view than the guest we had on last week?
Yeah, I guess I can start with my own story, which is that my first transgender patient came to me and explained that he had felt that he was really a boy since the age of three. And I said, oh, you know what? That is a thing. We have a clinic. I can send you there. And I sent him there, and they affirmed him and put him on testosterone. And that seemed fine. But then the next one that came in to me, I work as a pediatrician in Gresham, which is a suburb of Portland, Oregon. The next kid that came in, I am not an expert, but did not, I was not, I am now, but I was not an expert, did not really seem to have that persistent, consistent, insistent history. And I referred that young person to the gender clinic, expecting that, as your guest from last week said, that there would be a rigorous process of differential diagnosis, and this young person would be told, no, you're not actually trans. But that is not what happened. This person was also affirmed as trans, was started on testosterone, had a double mastectomy in between graduating high school and starting college. And subsequently to that, I had a 12-year-old who was with a brand new identity, offered puberty blockers at the first visit. And I just started to get really concerned that children were being rushed into a medical pathway that we really don't know how safe it is.
Do you think it's a matter of it just needs more, they just need more time to truly develop what they're feeling in consultation with their parents and their doctor?
I do think that young people need more time to figure out who they are. I mean, everybody who is an adult can remember how confusing and dramatic adolescence was. Adolescence is a really key developmental period. It's a time of identity formation. And right now, we have this thing. There's a term they use in psychology called the symptom pool. And it's basically, and it's culturally based, it's the way that you express your distress is different from place to place and from time to time. And right now, our culture is telling young people that if they feel, if they don't like themselves, if they feel uncomfortable in their body, then maybe that's because they're actually born in the wrong body, and what they need to do is change their body, and then their life will come together. So there are many pathways into gender dysphoria. And what I'd like to say is there are also many pathways out, and they don't necessarily involve hormones and surgery.
We're talking again with Dr. Julia Mason, a pediatrician board member of the group Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, who has a very different view from our guest last week on the very passionate issue of transgender care for children. So, Dr. Mason, what would you tell parents who have children who come to them, if they come to them? In some cases, as you know, the children may not go to their parents. But if they do, or if their parents find out, what should they do?
That is an excellent question. You need to maintain the relationship. That is your primary goal as a parent, is to maintain your relationship with your child. And if the child has been involved with groups that are promoting transition, gender transition as the solution to your problems, they've told your kid that if your parents don't 100% support you, they are transphobic and they hate you. And you want to persist in your love for your child and your support for your child, but I personally don't recommend going to your local gender clinic to try to have them figure it out, because my professional organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, put out a statement in 2018 that they reinforced in 2023 that the only person who knows if a child is trans is that child, that the only way you can figure out if a child is trans is you ask them. And I've been a pediatrician for over 30 years, and I don't let children decide important things like whether they're getting vaccinations, whether they're taking this antibiotic, and definitely whether they're being given life-altering medications and surgeries.
I mean, would you argue that the majority of these young people are not trans, or do you hold that understanding that there are many of them that really truly are?
I would say that when I was in medical school, 40 years ago, trans was a thing that happened in 2 out of 10,000. It was vanishingly rare. And it was mostly boys. And even amongst those kids, a supermajority of them desisted when they hit puberty. And most of them figured out that they were gay. And I worry now that we are telling gender nonconforming children that the fact that they don't fit into the rigid box, it really feels like gender roles are more severe than they were when I was a child. If we have a boy who likes sparkles and wants to wear a dress, we're telling him that his desire for feminine things means there's something wrong with him, that he has a boy's brain, he has a girl's brain in his boy's body, but no problem. You know, we can change his name, we can grow out his hair, we'll put him in dresses, and then when he's older, the doctors will change his sex.
But let me ask you something. But let me ask something very quickly, mm-hmm. Doctor, because you mentioned that 40 years ago when you were in medical school, it was considered a very rare medical issue. But could that be that, in 40 years since then, society has changed, cultural norms have changed, and maybe even children feel less ashamed or embarrassed to admit to either their parents, their friends, themselves, what their mm-hmm. true conditions might be?
Well, I want children who don't feel comfortable with their to be able to wear what they want to wear, pursue the interests that they want, and be themselves without any medical treatments. I don't think medical treatments are required for gender nonconforming children.
Dr. Julia Mason, pediatrician, board member of the Group Society for Evidence-Based Gender Medicine, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We are talking about the issue of banking regulations coming up next.
It's Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM. This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the show. Along with Charles Feldman, I'm Margaret Carrero. It was just a year and a half ago when the Silicon Valley Bank unexpectedly collapsed, causing billions of dollars in losses and stoking fears that perhaps America's banking system wasn't as stable and secure as we thought. And while we all tend to have short memories, go back 16 years ago to 2008 when several major banks and investment institutions folded, setting off the Great Recession that lasted 2 years. In spite of all of that, the Trump administration is toying with the idea of curtailing banking regulations.
You know, you mentioned the Silicon Valley Bank,
yeah.
and significantly, depositors didn't lose a dime, and they didn't. Investors lost money.
Right.
The depositors didn't because of the FDIC.
Mm-hmm.
The Wall Street Journal is reporting that the Trump transition team is exploring ways to shrink, consolidate, or even eliminate some of the top bank watchdog groups, including, as I just mentioned, the FDIC. Sultan Meghji served as chief innovation officer at the FDIC. In fact, one of the regulators, as we mentioned, in the crosshairs of the Trump administration. Sultan, thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
So one of the things that apparently the transition team is talking about is either the elimination of or consolidation of some of these regulators. And I'm wondering if you think if that's not necessarily a bad idea. I looked up the figures. Currently, there are about 13,000 people employed by the various banking regulators in the country. Couldn't that be reduced?
It's an interesting question, and I think the short answer is yes, because we have, and I don't think a lot of people really realize this, we actually have two parallel banking systems here in the United States. We have one focused on banks that are chartered at the state level, and then we have another that's focused on chartering at the federal level. And so at a minimum, you have, in many cases, duplicative work. You have work being done at the state level that's also then being done at the federal level. So that's one big category. That 13,000 number, by the way, is on the low side because, you know, it doesn't include contractors and a bunch of other infrastructure. And so I think the number is probably closer to 40,000 people.
40,000? Wow. Couldn't 20,000 do the same job?
Well, you know, one of the most interesting things about the federal banking regulatory system, so the federal side of that, is it comes out of a bunch of laws that are, you know, before the Vietnam War. And, you know, these are things that predate fax machines or, you know, in many cases, any digital technology at all. And so there's a tremendous amount of manual human paper-based work that occurs. So, for example, there are these things called call reports that banks have to submit to the regulators on a quarterly basis. It can take almost another full quarter for that data to get compiled and organized, et cetera, because it's coming in as a fax or coming in as a PDF, when in reality it should be in an Excel spreadsheet or, you know, just a data connection. And so I wouldn't at all be surprised to see a significant number of people dropped simply by using modern technology to automate out a lot of it. So that to me is a very easy place. It also would really decrease the overall risk to the banking system and remove a lot of human error. And it would allow us to get in front of bank failures like the Silicon Valley Bank collapse that you mentioned in the intro.
Could there be any unintended consequences, though, of doing this?
Oh, absolutely. A lot of the technologists that are good at building these kinds of technologies don't work for the U.S. government and aren't federal technology contractors. And so there's a tremendous risk of putting in a bunch of unproven technology inside of a regulatory system that in many cases hasn't been updated for a century.
How much of this, though, could be a problem psychologically? I mean, if you eliminate the FDIC, but you consolidate it so that some other branch of government insures depositors, how will depositors react after decades of being told as a sales pitch by banks, don't worry, your deposit up to a certain amount is going to be insured by, there are those letters again, the FDIC?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at the breakdown of work at the FDIC between running the insurance fund and examining banks for risk, it's not even close. It's like 95% of the staff are bank examiners, bank regulators, and administrative staff. And about 5% are running a very simple insurance program. You know, there are only just over 4,000 banks in the United States now. You know, there used to be almost 40,000 banks in the 80s. And so you could take the insurance function, leave that at the FDIC, pull all the examiners out of the FDIC, who most of them are already assigned to something called the FFIEC, which is a group that includes staff from the FDIC, the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is part of the Treasury Department, and the Federal Reserve. You could take all of that and do a significant consolidation exercise while leaving the FDIC in place. And frankly, that would be easier from a legal perspective too, because you wouldn't be undoing the FDIC or the insurance. You would just be changing who has the responsibility for examining the banks and taking and separating that from the insurance fund.
We are speaking with Sultan Meghji, who served as Chief Innovation Officer at the FDIC. We continue our examination of Trump plans for the banking industry next.
This is Countdown 2024
on KNX News 97.1 FM.
Welcome back to the Friday edition of Countdown 2024. Along with Margaret Carrero, I'm Charles Feldman.
Former FDIC bank regulator Sultan Meghji remains with us as we finish up our conversation on the future of banking oversight in the Trump administration. So I was wondering, going back to Silicon Valley Bank and its collapse last year, should banks really be so confident that they'll be better off with less oversight?
That's an amazing question, and one that I don't think anybody can say they have a great answer to. The vast majority of banks that fail, you discover that they're failing because of something on their balance sheet, but you it's not like you get a year's warning. You get maybe a few weeks, maybe a few months warning most of the time, the way they do it right now. All of the banks that failed or had to go into forced M&A over the last few years, with one exception, were showing something on their balance sheets more than just a few months in advance. So it's a historical aberration. And so as we look at any potential regulatory changes, there are some changes that have begun in our financial system over the last 20 years, and the internet is part of it, mobile payments, you know, the ability to use Apple Pay and tap your phone to pay and things like that. Those are all things that the regulatory system is still coming to terms with. And so I would say that my own personal view is that the risk to the system is probably overall higher than is generally appreciated, but a significant regulatory change, if done in an irresponsible manner, would actually make it even worse.
They're mostly billionaires that are pushing this. What do they gain?
Well, if you have less banks and you have more control over the payments rails and more control over the deposits that allow for you to then leverage against that to get loans, to then go off and, you know, do other things with that money, that it makes it a lot easier to for them to get access to that. You know, it used to be that you would get your car loan and your house loan from a bank. Now, most of the time, that's no longer the case. You're getting it from, you know, something that ends up looking at private equity where the multiples are better, and there's a different set of math there. You know, overall, billionaires and people who are trying to control the banking system, it allows them to get the banking system to operate together to create a kind of a, I would call it a closed loop system that they can then control in a vertically integrated way. They can control the payments. They can control the lending. They can control credit. They can control all of those things and eke more money out of it. And then that allows them to then, you know, get a better return on their investment.
Former FDIC bank regulator Sultan Meghji, thank you so much for your time today.
Coming up on Monday's Countdown 2024, California Republicans have long sought to put a dagger through the heart of the state's troubled high-speed rail project. And now, with Donald Trump about to be back in the White House, they just might get their chance. We will talk with the California Republican congressman who hopes to partner with Elon Musk to kill high-speed rail. If you missed the show, catch up on demand on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search Countdown 2024 and follow the show.